Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. We call this the Salute to Uwe Reinhardt Show, and I will explain this. Admittedly, the title's been kind of getting out of hand here. But there's a reason for this. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. Shelley Irving is still on assignment in Isomville, apparently covering late-breaking
news. Must be a tough one.
Yeah, this is a big story. We can't wait for her to get back and explain it all to us. But in her stead, we are still joined by the capable Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure to explain to you how to access Health Matters on the web, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know, you can get the audio of the show at WMKY.org. That's right. Morehead State Public Radio website. That's where you go when you want to listen to the show, either live or on a recorded basis. It's all there. After that, jump over to Facebook.com/HM Radio Show. There you'll find the fan page for Health Matters. That's where we interact with everyone. And yes, we do our own voiceovers on that site. We actually participate in the dialogue, and again, it is a great way to provide feedback, interact with the show, Facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor, Cough Management, let's nail that coughing before it gets worse. Cough Management, causes of chronic cough. If you have a cough, and admittedly it's early in the season, but I thought we ought to get this information out to you, lasts more than 3 weeks. If you are not a smoker and you are not taking a blood pressure medicine called an ACE inhibitor, they make you cough about one time in six, you're going to have an upper airway cough syndrome, used to be called post-nasal drip. You're going to have asthma. You're going to have some type of a non-asthmatic bronchitis or esophageal reflux disease, acid reflux disease, if you all the other causes have been ruled out. Those are your most common causes of a cough lasting more than 3 weeks in a non-smoker. There aren't many non-smokers in eastern Kentucky because many of us who, even though we don't smoke, we get exposed to other people's smoke. But if you happen to be one of those lucky people that is not exposed to smoke, not taking the ACE inhibitors for blood pressure, those are your top causes of cough. Treatments. We'll talk about this more second fractional portion, but the first treatment, the top treatment, we call them first-generation antihistamines with decongestants, and that's pseudoephedrine. So that is the antihistamine D. The second-generation antihistamines are not as effective. So when you're looking at a Claritin or an Allegra, sure, you're wide awake, but they're not quite as good as the first. The second thing you need to know, and we'll stop there, dextromethorphan, that's the DM, that's the Robitussin DM. Robitussin also has guaifenesin, a mystery ingredient that doesn't seem to do much of anything. And also even codeine for cough associated with infection, not effective, not recommended. The placebo response was 85% in six studies of these cough medicine. That is, when they just took a sugary solution that didn't have any of the medicine in it, 85% of them, their cough got better just by taking that.
Did that help because they lubricated their throat maybe?
Yeah, this is not rocket surgery. It is pretty darn simple. It's not that hard. What you need to do is to coat the throat so it's not as irritated, and you need to prevent the stuff dripping down from above. So if you can use pseudoephedrine, and again, it comes as Sudafed, but it's also in all the Ds. And if you can coat the throat, honey, warm liquids, anything like that, don't use the guaifenesin. The guaifenesin is really strange. Guaifenesin supposedly irritates your lungs. Now, keep in mind you're drinking it, but somehow drinking guaifenesin irritates your lungs, makes it easier for the fluid to get out. They weep out fluid, and you're able to cough that up easier. That is the textbook explanation of guaifenesin. Makes no sense whatsoever. If you took guaifenesin and it worked, and you took dextromethorphan and it suppressed your cough, you would drown.
Drowned?
Yeah, because you're making more fluid and you're suppressing the cough at the same time, so you don't cough the fluid up, so you drown. And that's how silly that cough medicines are. And I know, you know, they've got pictures of that blue-collar mucus plug, and somehow it just takes a vacation whenever you take their product or things like that. But the truth of the matter is they do that because there is no legitimate mechanism for these cough suppressant medicines. Eliminate the sinus drainage, coat the throat. That's all you can do. You cannot get down there and some way loosen up mucus. And they've tried. They tried using IV fluids to hydrate people with asthma to see if it would be easier to cough things up, and it didn't work. So you're not going to drink anything that is going to then somehow congregate in your lungs and make it easier to cough out than sleeveless shirts that are inhabiting your bronchial tubes. That is our sponsor, Cough Management. Let's nail that coffin before it gets worse. We start off with a very provocative article. This is Health Day, November
11. Yeah, why'd you go here right from the start?
I told Rick about this article on the way over, and he was horrified.
Yeah.
He threatened to boycott this show.
I am actually not going to – just go ahead and talk. I'm not going to say
Rick is
going to
be
anything.
In silence. So I'm going to – I am now – what I will do is – I will imitate Rick. Let's be honest.
Well, you know what? I am a bit intrigued by this, though.
Okay.
Because, I mean, honestly, this is a little bit pertinent to the time. There's been a lot of bad things happening around misconduct. Let's call it misconduct.
Misconduct. Let's talk about it. First of all, you need to know there are 350,000 cardiac arrests outside the hospital in the U.S. every year.
Now, that means people dropping.
Yeah, they just person drops, their heart stops or beats rapidly, and they no longer have a blood pressure and a pulse.
So before you get too far along, so the interruption won't really hurt you, have you, and you're a doctor, so obviously you've had people in the hospital drop in front of you. Have you ever had somebody drop in front of you outside the hospital and not associated with your medical practice?
Sure, I understand. No.
I have. It's pretty weird. I was walking out of a UK basketball game on a side road one night, and a guy collapsed right in front of him.
You did CPR.
He was actually breathing still. So, but he fell, collapsed, passed out, but he was breathing. And we did in fact have 911. There was, you know, it was pretty traumatic.
350,000. Now, the thing you need to know, unlike on TV, 9 out of 10 of those people don't make it.
He did.
If you collapse on the sidewalk 9 times, and your heart, and you don't have a pulse, and people are doing CPR, 9 times out of 10, that's not going to work.
Now, there was an awful lot of, this was after a UK basketball game.
Yeah.
It was very difficult to get the ambulance to him.
Yeah. On the other hand, there were a lot of people there to help out.
No, they were all in their cars. I mean, really, there wasn't a big, it was.
Okay. Fair enough. Don't do this at a UK basketball game, apparently. But at any rate, 9 out of 10, speedy CPR can double or triple your chances. Says the American Heart Association, and this was reported at the American Heart Association. Now, they looked at 19,000 cases of cardiac arrest, these researchers, that occurred outside the hospital between 2011 and 2015. 4 years, 19,000 cases. Men in public settings were 23% more likely than women to receive bystander CPR and had a 23% better odds of survival in a public place outside the hospital, in public settings. In the home, no difference in response, no difference in survival. There is something about a woman falling in public that inhibits her getting CPR. And I will tell you in advance, as Rick struggles to figure out what to say on this, there is no answer. Well, this is just simply data analysis. No one knows why this occurs.
No, but I think what I was going to say is I think people's mind is naturally going to gravitate towards what you think it might be.
Right.
And I think, hence, that's why they're looking at the research, because I think the hypothesis probably was very similar on the, you know, what they're trying to prove or disprove.
Yeah.
But if it turns out to be true, it's a little bit.
Yeah, and they said, the researchers said, we didn't look for this. We didn't expect this. And this was done, again, it was reported in 2017, but they looked at the CPR between 2011 and 2015. Of course, Rick and I are talking about the fact that there are a large number of public people, celebrities, politicians, and so forth, who have been accused of being inappropriately physical toward women. And so is this, in fact, the source of the inhibition for women getting CPR when they collapse on the sidewalk? Do people not want to mess with a woman's chest to take chances? Now, as I said, no one has said this, but it is an intriguing question of why public arrest for women does not result in CPR, 23% better chance of surviving for males, and 23% better, 3% more likely to get CPR, whereas in the home, it's even. I don't know the answer to this. That a couple of things they mentioned, when it comes to life and death, we need to reassure the public we're not worrying about what seems socially inappropriate, said Benjamin Abella, director of University of Pennsylvania Center for Resuscitation Science. Do not hesitate. And here's their recommendations. Two-thirds of people, regardless of their gender, don't get bystander CPR when their heart is stopped. We've got to fix this. Witnesses should immediately call 911 and then start hands-only CPR on that person. You do not have to give mouth-to-mouth. Put one hand over the other, middle of the chest, push down and up 100 to 120 times a minute, and we use the song Staying Alive. Basically, you're thumping them, staying alive, staying alive. Hit with me, Rick.
I don't think I will.
Staying alive. That's how fast you're going to be doing that CPR. How about that? That was unexpected, wasn't it? And that was terrible. I didn't even go falsetto.
That was embarrassing. Tell you what, doing the Bee Gees.
Thing is, Brian's going to cover this up. He's going to put the Bee Gees right on top of this. You'll never know this even happened.
No, he won't. Because believe me, we will.
So
some of us had to live it.
Hands-only CPR. Do that and do that. Again, if they don't have a pulse, they're not responding to you, you do not see them breathing, start that. And do it through clothing. Don't worry about undergarments. Just start doing it because that's their one chance to survive. And the odds are 9 out of 10 people are not going to survive anyway if they have any chance at all. You've got to get on this. All 50 states have Good Samaritan laws that protect you against legal action, something you're not as aware of as you should be, for whatever reason, whether it's a man or a woman, whether they're clean or dirty, whether you know them or don't. If there is a person lying there and they are unresponsive, they don't have a pulse, they're not breathing, you should do something.
I mean, where can you go with this, Tony?
Yeah. So
are they going to do more research, you think?
This was data analysis. Now, this is superimposed on the fact that we're all reluctant to start CPR anyway. And it may be more reluctant for women.
But less likely, less
on men. 19,000 cases. I don't think this is a little data fluke. I think there is something about a woman collapsing that makes people slower. Maybe it be they're worried about breaking bones, or maybe they're worried about, again, the social taboos. I don't know. It's already hard enough to get CPR done. We've got to get that information out. And especially, again, if you're in a rural area, where many of our listeners are, you may be the only one. You should take CPR classes. We should get good at this. We have high rates of cardiac arrest, high rates of cardiac disease in our state. We need people to be able to respond. And then secondly, you should not hesitate to respond if you sense there's a problem. The thing about it is, you know, if you're wrong, if they're just asleep, once you start doing this, they're going to wake up really fast.
Right.
So you're not going to accidentally resuscitate people who don't need to be resuscitated. I mean, you might for a few seconds, but that's going to end pretty quickly.
They're just going to wake up with your hand on their chest.
Right.
Which is, I think, what the thing is suggesting they don't want to happen.
Well, we're going to take a break and stop talking about this.
Thank you. Come back
with a brand new topic in our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is our salute to Uwe Reinhardt. The late and great health economist. This is a guy that I really admired, and I thought, since he has recently passed, I thought this would be an excellent time to salute him. The other thing, as I put this thing together, first of all, you know, I'm not a big endorser of movies, and we don't endorse any products on this show. But I will tell our radio fans, over Thanksgiving, my daughter took us to several movies that she wanted to see, and there was one called The Man Who Invented Christmas. And this is about Charles Dickens. And this was, in my mind, a very good movie. Basically, it is, for the most part, historically accurate and talks about the writing of A Christmas Carol. And I learned a lot about Charles Dickens, but I was well entertained by this. Now, the reason I mention that is because as I came back and I started working on this show, it occurred to me that we are, in fact, living in Dickensian, I guess, world of healthcare.
Bah humbug?
Yeah. First of all, Uwe Reinhardt, 80 years old, Princeton University professor, died second week of November, I think around the 15th. Five things to know. Born in Germany, recognized leader in healthcare economics, written in the New York Times, doing a journal of medicine, British Medical Journal. He was called the narrator of U.S. healthcare policy. Very precise in his word use, very witty. We'll give you some quotes from him and you'll realize that. Member of the Institute of Medicine, National Academy of Sciences since 1978. He led the Association of Health Services Research as president and acting commissioner on the Congressional Physician Payment Review Commission in 1986 and 1995, PhD from Yale University. The last thing that I saw that he did, they had essentially almost like a March Madness between healthcare systems. The U.S. faced off against France after we had defeated Taiwan and moved on and faced off against France. Meanwhile, Germany and Canada was lined up against England, and England had a more comprehensive national health service than Canada, so they won that round. The U.S. dropped out in the second round. France had a better healthcare system than us, and the ultimate champion, world champion healthcare system was actually Switzerland. They were able to integrate a private and public elements into a comprehensive health care services that did not overcharge people, did not bankrupt people, and provided health care for their people.
They have all the banks and like 50 people.
Okay.
Should be pretty easy to do that, right?
Well, but their system makes sense and it's used properly.
Will it work at scale? Will it work with billion people?
Right. Will it work in a country like U.S.? People ask that. I'll throw it to you another way. Will it work if we fund it at around five times the amount of money that it's currently being funded? Because we spend so much money on health care. The bad thing about our health care system is that we spend more money than anybody else. The good thing about it is we have more money to spend than anybody else. So we could supercharge a Canadian or a British or a Swiss health care system by putting more money into it than they did. Our problem is we've got some fundamental things that we have to fix before we could even consider that.
Right.
And my good friend Yule Scott, who is constantly lecturing me on universal health care, he talks about the fact that we've got to get these profit-oriented people out of our health care system in order to make it work. I tend to agree with him. I think we've got a problem there that we're just going to have to work out before we can go. I've got let me explain this, and I'm going to get to Reinhardt's quotes. This was Bloomberg Views, a woman named Ayla Ellison, November 28th, reported healthcare bankruptcies more than triple in 2017. The challenges are going to hit rural hospitals the hardest because they're losing something called the disproportionate share hospital payments. Rural hospitals used to get paid specifically for taking care of people that didn't have insurance. Then everybody got insurance, and the disproportionate share payments were supposed to go away. The Obama administration planned to phase them out. The problem is the payments didn't come. People with high deductibles would default on their bills, and so these rural hospitals didn't see that swelling of economic benefit. And so now, as we scale back the disproportionate share payments, the bankruptcies are starting to mount up. Now, the reason I mention that is you think about it, we're spending all this money on health care, all this money going into the system, and yet the organizations that are providing health care are going bankrupt.
Right.
We're doing something wrong, and Reinhardt was one of the guys that said it. Now, I'm going to give you, first of all, I've got about 15 Reinhardt quotes. We're going to try to get through some of those. And at the end, if we have time, I'm going to take Reinhardt, and Rick is going to read from Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, and you can see how Uwe Reinhardt was, in fact, very much aligned with Jacob Marley and the people that tried to reform Ebenezer Scrooge. Now, first, we're just going to read 11 quotes from Uwe Reinhardt, and then we'll get to that. First quote, Uwe Reinhardt: "The Affordable Care Act is an ugly patch on an ugly system. I don't think it's worth mentioning in the context of price or quality transparency." That is his way of thinking. We're patching a bad system with the Affordable Care Act, and that's about all we're doing. It does not have cost containment. We're not able to figure out how much things actually cost. We're not able to compete on cost. As an economist, he found it to be really not a very good system. And I would echo that. It's a bad idea. If it transitions us to a better system, it's great. But by itself, it was not really as much help. Again, with these organizations going bankrupt, the bankruptcy rates have increased since the Affordable Care Act was passed. Quote number two, "We Americans, or half of Americans, think healthcare is a commodity. Other countries view healthcare as a social service that should be collectively financed and available to everyone on equal terms. He mentions his wife, and he just interviewed the German Minister of Health, and it was exhilarating because it was in a totally different language. It's obviously important that everyone should have the same deal in healthcare, and we don't believe that in the U.S. And he felt that was wrong. He's an economist. He knows the numbers, but this guy is an economist with a heart. Number three, the good things at the U.S. healthcare system are that we have a well-trained labor force, particularly physicians. I would agree with that. Reinhart says, I don't think any nation trains doctors better. We have the latest technology simply because we throw so much money at it. We are really technology hungry in this country. Does that hurt your feelings, Rick?
No, we are.
That's a good thing, says Reinhart. Our system treats patients like customers, which is a good thing. It's very customer friendly and it's very innovative, both in the products and the techniques and the organizational structures. Those are good things, highly competitive. That's what we've got to work with. We do well at innovation in this country still. Quote number four. If you want to look at a purely socialized healthcare system, you've got to go to the United States, where we have socialized healthcare. In particular, we reserve that system for our veterans. So when politicians run down socialized medicine, I say, do you hate our veterans? Why do you put a socialized medicine system? There's only the U.S. and Cuba in the world that have that for our veterans. Getting the terms right would be very, very helpful in our national conversation. Government-sponsored socialized healthcare, that's what the VA is. If you don't like that, then why, you know, again, at his point, and his son was a veteran, so he was very, very sensitive to veterans' issues. He says, all right, if it's no good, why are you doing it for veterans?
And interestingly enough, I think it's been my experience that veterans that use the VA hospitals are extremely loyal to that particular method of healthcare, right? So once they get into that VA system, for whatever reason, every person I've known that's used the VA for their health care has been very loyal to the system.
It's a system. And I would say, you know, when you think about the holes and the exorbitant expenses of the hospitals that are right next door to the VAs, the fact that they're able to conduct their business at all is amazing. It's not optimal, but I'm amazed that they can even stay afloat given the type of system that they're operating in or next to.
Sure.
And they're running under an entirely different set of rules. Quote number five, everybody should have health care on the one hand, but on the other hand, if you ask Americans, are you willing to pay for it? They say no. I've never been able to understand this contradiction. Quote number six.
I mean, how do you refute that? I mean, it is weird.
Yeah. Yeah. What are you willing to do for each other? He felt that we owed each other. We had a responsibility to each other. I believe that as well. And I don't think that our current system allows us to really engage that responsibility. I feel like we just say every person for himself. Quote number six, we're the only nation where paper is still the mainstay in the private insurance industry. That's an older quote. I guess it's not so much anymore. Quote number seven, the rich are becoming richer. The gap between the rich and poor is getting bigger. Well, that's... Number eight, we have a nation where the elite thinks it's okay to advocate a war and send the lower-income people to do the fighting. Again, he was very concerned about our veterans. It's natural for such a people to think that the lower-income people should also have a worse healthcare experience. Other countries are not there. I always say, not there yet. I tell the Germans and Swiss, you're not there yet, but if you're not very, very careful, if we Americans come over there and rearrange your healthcare system, you'll be just like us.
Makes sense.
Well, yeah, you say, okay, the poor people don't have a right to the healthcare system I have. The poor people need their own healthcare system. They'll fight my wars. They'll endure inferior health outcomes and inferior health experiences. I don't owe them anything. They just need to be richer.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, we will export that if allowed.
I mean, I think it's probably safe to say that the world at times, usually when you're looking at success rates, knowledge base, that sort of thing, is very envious of the U.S. healthcare system. It's only when we start talking about the financial model of it and the accessibility of it do people start to bash on it, right?
Our technology is the best in the world.
Right.
But unfortunately,
and our training. I think our training and doctors are.
We can't afford it. That's our problem.
Right. We live beyond our means.
Quote number nine, the bad things. We talked about the good things. We got a good labor force. We're very innovative. The bad things is that our financing of healthcare is really a moral morass in the sense it signals to the doctors that human beings have different values depending on their income. For example, in New Jersey, the Medicaid program pays a pediatrician $30 to see a poor child on Medicaid. The legislators in New Jersey, through their insurance, pay the same pediatrician $100 to see their child. How do physicians react to it? If you phone around practices in New Jersey, and that's where he worked at Princeton, none of them would see Medicaid kids. Purely and simply, you get two different prices to see a child based on whether it's a rich child or a poor child.
Right.
And the doctors and the healthcare system responds to that. The poor child can't get a doctor. Quote number 10, we economists in our classes teach students that to some degree, price discrimination is a good thing. Take Africa with AIDS. They could never finance an AIDS cocktail at $10,000 a year. But if you sold it to them for $300 a year, they would serve quite a few of their citizens. We economists say that will be beneficial, but it's a two-tier system. Yeah, some people get a different level of care. African people pay less than we would pay. And quote number 11, I like this one. Americans keep telling me they hate government. I tell them, man, I've got a country for you. Go to Afghanistan if you don't want government. You can have your private paradise, but if you're comfortable with government, then go with government. And that's what America would look like without government. So as corrupt, as bad as government is, you have alternatives. Now, these next three. I'm going to read a quote from Uwe Reinhardt. Rick's going to read a passage from Dickens' Christmas Carol.
Okay.
All right. Number one, the issue of universal coverage of health care is not economics. Little more than 1% of the GDP assigned to health would cover all. It is a matter of soul.
Business. Mankind was my business. The common welfare was my business. Charity, mercy, forbearance, and benevolence were all my business. The dealings of my trade were but a drop of water in the comprehensive ocean of my business.
It's a matter of soul. Number two, this was about Hobby Lobby, where they went to the Supreme Court and said they were not going to, they should not be forced to subsidize certain aspects of health care, such as birth control. He said the Hobby Lobby ruling raises the question of why, uniquely in the industrialized world, Americans have for so long favored an arrangement in health insurance that endows their employers with a quasi-parental power to choose the options employees may be granted for their health insurance.
Scrooge had a very small fire, but the clerk's fire was so very much smaller that it looked like one coal. But he couldn't replenish it, for Scrooge kept the coal box in his own room. And so surely as the clerk came in with a shovel, the master predicted that it would be necessary for them to part. Wherefore, the clerk put on his white comforter and tried to warm himself at the candle, in which effort, not being a man of a strong imagination, he failed.
Why would you have the coal box in the boss's office? Why would you have your insurance with your employer?
Because it's the boss's.
Quote number three, the American people are not ready for the idea that everyone has at least a moral right to good, timely health care. They do agree they have a moral right in critical cases to have anything done to save their life, but they don't believe that anyone has the right not to fall that sick to begin with. So if you ask me, are we ever succumbing to some notions of solidarity as a nation? I would say not at all. I would describe us as a group of people who share a geography. Boy, no better words to describe today's time. A group of people who share a geography. That's a better description of Americans than that we're a real nation with a sense of solidarity. Again, the right to timely health care instead of the right to, in critical cases, have something done to save their life.
Many thousands are in a want of common necessaries. Hundreds of thousands are in want of common comforts, sir.
Well, are there no prisons?
Plenty of prisons, laying down the pen again.
And the union workhouses, are they still in operation?
They are still. I wish I could say they were not.
The treadmill and the poor law were in full vigor then?
Both very busy, sir.
Oh, I was afraid from what you said at first that something had occurred to stop them in their useful course. I'm very glad to hear it.
Under the impression that they scarcely furnish Christian cheer of mind or body to the multitude, a few of us are endeavoring to raise a fund to buy the poor some meat and drink and means of warmth. We chose this time because it is a time of all others when want is keenly felt and abundance rejoices. What shall I put down for you?
Nothing.
You wish to be anonymous?
I wish to be left alone. Since you asked me what I wish, gentlemen, that is my answer. I don't make myself merry at Christmas. I can't afford to make idle people merry. I help to support the establishments I have mentioned. They cost enough, and those who are badly off must go there. In other words, yes, you can support the poorhouses, you can support the emergency rooms, but can you give the poor people timely health care? Reinhardt had his thoughts on this, and frankly, I felt they align with Dickens. It made me realize we're in a Dickinsonian time when some people have the best of times and other people have the worst of times, when our institutions are designed to rescue the poor people rather than actually give them health, when our insurance, even though we're plowing trillions of dollars into health care, the very organizations that are supposed to deliver that health care are going bankrupt. These are, it's the perfect analogy for Christmas, our healthcare system. I believe if Dickens were alive today, Scrooge would have been a hospital executive or an insurance executive. That would have been Scrooge.
Tax collector.
Got one more thing, this fractional portion, and then we will end it up. This was November 8th in Science Translational Medicine. These scientists, this was an interesting thing. What they found, I'll just cut to the chase on this. Cuts and burns sustained during the day heal around 60% faster than those sustained at night.
Why? That's crazy.
Isn't that interesting? Nighttime burns, 8 p.m. to 8 a.m., 95% healed after 28 days, compared with only 17 days if it happened between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Now, here's the thing. You've got these circadian rhythms. You've always heard about them. These are the 24-hour cycles that our body's in. They regulate almost every cell in the body. And the skin cells, they took some mice. They made wounds at night and during the day. There is a certain protein, something called actin. It's a cytoskeletal protein that helps pull in the healing cells. It changed from day to night. So they found with these mice an intentional injury to a mouse would heal more slowly, and they found when they analyzed it that actin was the mediator and there was a circadian rhythm to actin. Then they looked at human burn injuries. When did they occur? How long did it take them to heal? And they found the same thing. They did not burn people, obviously, but they looked at people who had sustained burns, and they found the time of day on the burn was one of the keys to healing, because in those first critical moments, that burn may or may not recruit the kind of healing cells that were needed, and apparently you can't make up for that if you burn yourself at the wrong time. So please, let's go ahead and get ourselves injured during the day and save the night time for sleeping. I'll let you think about those deep recommendations from healthcare. We're going to take a break and come back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
Dr. Tony Weaver, this is the Salute to Uwe Reinhardt Show. And if you didn't hear it, then please get on the Moorhead State Public Radio site, WMKY.org, and go back and listen to those quotes from Reinhardt. Reinhardt, in many ways, was prescient. And I want you to understand, an economist with a heart says that our current system is blatantly unfair to those who are poor. It sets different values and different systems for different values on human life for rich people and poor people, and creates a different system for them. Sometimes that can work to their advantage, for instance, in getting low-cost medications for people in Africa. But in many cases, it's just simply morally wrong. And that's where we are, in our opinion, in our healthcare system today. And no tinkering with the Affordable Care Act will fix that. In that sense, I agree with my good friend Yule Scott. We're going to have to kind of go back to the drawing board and figure out a system, some form of universal system that protects all of our citizens. That's all I will say about that. Our sponsor for the final time, Cough Management. Let's nail that coffin before it gets worse. We call a chronic cough one that lasts more than 3 weeks. If you don't smoke, first of all, if you smoke, stop smoking. My goodness.
Well, yeah, haven't you been listening to the show for all these years?
We're embarrassed. Why don't you turn the radio off? I'm sorry.
At least lie to us and tell us you quit.
Yeah, but stop smoking. There is a blood pressure medicine called an ACE inhibitor. These are the prills. And I've told you, these are good blood pressure medicine. If it ends in prill, it's a darn good pill. This is captopril, enalapril, lisinopril. Acupril, and others. The brand names, although the most common one is the lisinopril, far and away. But these drugs are very good blood pressure medicines, but they about one time in six can cause a cough, and occasionally you have to stop the medicine because you just won't stop. It's a dry cough with no watery nose or anything like that. But let's say you're a non-smoker. Let's say you're not taking one of these drugs. You've got four possibilities. Upper airway cough syndrome, used to be called post-nasal drip. Bacterial sinusitis, allergic rhinitis, something wrong with your sinuses. You're dripping stuff back down, and that's causing you to cough. Two, asthma. There's a cough variant asthma that when you go up the stairs or when you get out of breath, you just start coughing. You don't necessarily wheeze. You just cough a lot. Non-asthmatic bronchitis. Best treatment for that, whatever is allergic response, whatever's causes the allergies that lead to the non-asthmatic bronchitis, get rid of those things, try to avoid those things. It's not really an antibiotic type problem with a chronic cough due to that. And then finally, acid reflux disease. That we believe can reflux back into the back of your throat and irritate your throat and cause a cough. Treatment. First generation antihistamines. This is the Benadryl, diphenhydramine, or the chlorpheniramine. These make you sleepy, but they're really much better at drying out your mouth than the Allegra, or drying out the back of your mouth than and your sinuses than the Allegra or the Claritin. You combine those with pseudoephedrine, so that it has a big D on the end of it. And I will tell you, even though the first-generation antihistamines are better, I will use the Claritin D or the generic stuff, the loratadine D, the house brand of that, because it's cheaper. Once-a-day pill with 240 milligrams of pseudoephedrine, probably as good as you can get for what it does is it clamps down on the blood vessels in your nose. You got to be careful if you got high blood pressure. But if you don't have high blood pressure or if it's well controlled, you can take pseudoephedrine, clamps down on those blood vessels, shrinks those swollen sinus passageways. And remember, that's the problem. You cannot blow your nose clear. One trial indicated that naproxen, that's Aleve over the counter, is effective also for a cough. That's interesting. I read that, still haven't used it. The cough medicines. Dextromethorphan, that's the DM. Guaifenesin, that's what's in Robitussin and other products. And codeine is a cough suppressant. They don't work in coughs associated with infection. The placebo response, if you take any type of a sticky liquid, throw a little alcohol in there, 85% response in six studies. Codeine, no more effective than placebo in adults and children. I mean, it's just codeine is just not to be used for cough. Sorry about that. European Medicines Agency prohibits the use of codeine to treat cough in people younger than 12. Guaifenesin is FDA approved for cough, but as we mentioned last time, it makes absolutely no sense to use guaifenesin. How does something you drink or take by mouth go to your stomach and make you cough less if it does not coat the back of your throat? And guaifenesin doesn't. Just get some honey, some warm liquids, use the decongestants, maybe a little Aleve, but please don't take those silly things. Benzonatate. Tessalon, pearls, FDA approved for children older than 10, not found to be effective either. American Academy of Pediatrics says over-the-counter cough and cold medicines are not effective for children younger than 6. And if you do take one of those ACE inhibitors, sometimes you change brands, you can get some improvement. Our sponsor, Cough Management, nail that coughing before it gets worse. Physical activity, Rick, it's a good thing.
It is.
November 23rd, Oxford, United Kingdom, a study of 500,000 people without cardiovascular disease showed that total physical activity related to work, recreation, or other needs, such as walking to do errands, was associated with a lower term risk of developing cardiovascular disease. That is, in America, we, of course, take our cars and ride our cars to the parking lot, hop on a Segway or a moving walkway, take the escalator, and go to a gym where we have a membership. And we walk on a treadmill.
Okay.
There are parts of the world where they actually walk on dirt.
I have
seen it in a documentary. And that works every bit as well, it turns out. So whether it is for work, recreation, or whether it's just to get jobs done, if you do physical activity, the more physical activity you do, the lower your risk of heart disease. They had participants that they mentioned they did this around the world. Different income levels, different countries. China, much average middle income Chinese, much higher average level of physical activity. 5 hours of cycling or brisk walking a day equivalent.
Okay.
That's a lot of walking.
Brisk.
With each extra 1 hour of brisk walking or that equivalent per day, something that makes you out of breath, 5% to 12% lower risk of developing heart disease during the 7.5-year follow-up. 7.5 years, every hour extra, dropped your risk of heart disease by somewhere 5 to 12%. That's pretty good. Similar in men, similar in women, similar in young people, similar in old people. People with high blood pressure, physical activity were weaker, although these people around the world, less than 10% of these actually had controlled high blood pressure. So we don't know if you control your high blood pressure, you're probably okay. I am confessing to the crowd here on the radio, this is a problem I have. My job has gotten busier. I do not find time to exercise the way I should.
And you still don't walk between things. So you segue everywhere?
I'm not even going to be funny about that. I will tell you, you know, I do walk. The hospital is about a block away from my office. I walk back and forth a couple of times a day, but that's not nearly enough. You know, I spend a lot of time looking up Health Matters stuff on my computer.
Right. And, you know, when you do actually go between buildings, you should take the farthest door away from the building and go into the farthest door away from the other building.
I had a partner that said the handicapped parking spaces ought to be on the far side of the parking lot. Not cruel, but simply saying if you had an illness particularly, you would need to walk a long way. And we do spend a lot of time searching for that premier parking space when we would live longer if we parked on the other side of the parking lot. And we'd also... It'd be about the same time getting to the building, because after you've lapped the parking lot a couple of times looking for the closed space, you just pull in, park, start walking.
Right.
Healthier, happier. You're not fighting anybody for a parking space. And 5 to 12%, if you're an hour away from the building, 5 to 12% lower risk of heart disease.
Well, but couldn't you do, you know, instead of being an hour away from the building, couldn't you go to the, if you went to the building six times a day, couldn't you do like a 10 minute from the building?
Yeah, you know, I mean, people keep arguing about that. They say, no, you got to get your heart up and get it sustained. The exercise purists do. I think we are struggling, most of us, to exercise, and any burst of activity is good. Obviously, taking the stairs, one flight up, two flights down, keeps your tummy from getting round. You know, we've used that for a long time. If you're not going up five flights of stairs, why not take the stairs instead of taking the elevator? Try to avoid the elevator. Try to take the stairs. Try to walk different places and make yourself get up and walk. And one of the things that I try to do is instead of calling somebody on the phone, if they're a floor down from me or something like that, is actually walk down to their office. It's more fun. The interactions are better. And also, I do get away from my desk. But even knowing that, still spending too much time sitting, I have that problem. This right here is another example. I truly believe that any type of physical activity done for any purpose in any way is good for you, that it actually improves your health. And then obviously if you can spend an hour doing an elliptical or something like that that keeps your heart rate up and stay hydrated with your water bottle and so forth, that's a great thing. But if you can't do that, if you can just walk a little bit more, that's a good thing.
I mean, here's the old Fitbit argument, right? So the Fitbit's supposed to tell you whether you're doing this or not. So I have tried, luckily, UK in their, you know, and I think if I were to say something bad about parking, I don't know that I'd get in a ton of trouble because I think I'd be in the probably the majority of people. I mean, parking has just gotten very difficult at UK. And so you find yourself where I used to park right outside my building. Now it's a little farther walk, and so I'm getting a lot closer to my daily steps just because, you know, if I go to lunch, you know, it's between going to work, to lunch, back from lunch, back to the car to go home, I'm generating, you know, 5,000-6,000 steps just to get to my car.
Yeah, and we would say, well, that's ridiculous. You know, you need to get they need to fix the parking.
No,
but in actuality, you know, that is good.
Well, I mean, yeah, I agree with you, Tony. I think from a human and from a health standpoint, it is good. There are productivity issues, right? I mean, there are definitely people are spending, especially when you get into an environment where, you know, my shift starts at 8, does my shift start when I close the car door or does my shift start once I walk through the building?
Oh, speaking as your boss and supervisor, absolutely not, son. You need to get to work on time, buddy. I need to see you in the seat.
Okay, so what if I need to use my car during the day to go somewhere? Because, I mean, we have an 800-acre campus. We have, you know, places all around Lexington. So if I have to go to my car to get somewhere, now I've just burned 20, 30 minutes. That stuff adds up from a productivity. So, yes, I think while I am slightly poking at the parking situation, obviously it's probably gotten my step count up to the point where I'm at least approaching a normal step count for a lazy adult.
You know, and the thing is, we can change the built environment to help this out. The perfect example here in Moorhead, if people know, there are parts of the St. Clair Hospital system that were built in the 1960s and 1970s. And if you go look at the stairwells in the old hospital, those stairwells are concrete. They are very steep. They have no windows because they're built to be fireproof, and they are joyless. Meanwhile, the elevators in that same area, they are lined with fake walnut paneling, and they have nice floors and so forth. They are meant to be attractive. Then you come across the street to the Center for Health Education Research, which is where I work. The elevators, in fact, are small and cramped and very undecorated. The stairwells have floor-to-ceiling windows all the way up the stairwells. The slope is better. The stair treads are better. And people take those stairs. So just the way you create the stairwells and create the elevators creates the culture and makes a change. And likewise, if you can have covered walkways, shady walkways, if you do some landscaping, those type of things make a change. And so if you have anything to do with your environment, if you are in charge of that, or if you're able to reach the people who are, make it easier to walk. Make it easier to go to climb the stairs. This is really your health and your life we're talking about, and you need to have easy ways to exercise because, as Rick mentioned, it's not like you can take time off to exercise. You need to build it into your routine in small amounts. Now, I'll give you that, you know, you got to have adequate parking, but we got to find some way to keep you from getting glued to your desk.
Right.
And it needs to be enjoyable. It needs to be just a part of your culture to get up and move around. Well, here's the other side of it. This was July 17th. This has been a couple of years ago. July 17th, 2014 was when it was first reported, but then they updated it in October, and so it caught my attention. This was an article in The New Yorker from cardiologist in Brigham and Women's, Lisa Rosenbaum. And she looked at extreme exercise, running a marathon, doing things like that, to serious heart conditions and even death. So this is the downside of exercise. This is what she said, I like this. She said, Darwin was wrong about one thing. It's not survival of the fittest, but survival of the moderately fit. She mentions James O'Keefe, one-time extreme runner, won the Kansas City Sprint Triathlon 5 years in a row, says, I may have made a lethal mistake. It may have been a bad idea. This is what they did. In 2013, they looked at 10 years' worth of data on the rates of atrial fibrillation. That is that common irregular heartbeat that they're advertising the blood thinners on TV for. It happens quite a bit. My numbers say about 5% of people over age 70 will get it. They looked at 50,000 Swedish men who had participated in a 90-kilometer cross-country ski race. These are extremely fit Swedish men. The people who had the fastest times or did the most races had the highest risk of the atrial fibrillation. They looked at another study, 11 million marathoners and half marathoners. 59 suffered a cardiac arrest during the race, one cardiac arrest every 184,000 runners. Men more likely to have heart problems than women. Runners more likely to die from coronary artery disease. That's the number one killer among young athletes. Go back to a 2006 study. Why heart problems seem to affect extreme runners more than others. Researchers looked at heart size and function of 60 non-elite marathoners directly after a race. A high percentage, a large percentage, had evidence of an enlarged heart and increased heart stiffness. 50% of the runners had elevated enzymes that signal heart cell damage. So when you go to extreme levels of exercise, not walking in from the parking lot. We're talking about marathons, ultramarathons, triathlons, and so forth. It can possibly damage your heart. Here's what they said. Train properly. The people who did best in their marathon were people who had trained by running more than 45 miles a week. That is, you don't do this just to see if you can endure the pain. You prepare for it so that your body is ready. Build up to it. Same thing. Know your genetics. If there's a family history of heart disease, a physician should be consulted before starting an intense exercise regimen. And then, again, the former marathon runner recommends limiting vigorous exercise to 30 to 50 minutes per day. Running too far, too fast, too many years may actually speed your progress toward the finish line, according to O'Keefe. So exercise, but not extreme exercise for long periods of time. That's the ticket, and we need to get off the air.
Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song. And to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
according to Consumer Reports, Health Matters is used to treat mild to moderate pain due to certain conditions, including osteoarthritis. Osteoarthritis is the most common type of arthritis, involves breakdown of cartilage in the joints leading to pain, stiffness, and immobility.
Like ibuprofen and other arthritis medicines, Health Matters blocks the production of substances in the body called prostaglandins. Those chemicals play a role in pain, inflammation, fever, muscle cramps, and aches. At low doses, Health Matters works mainly as a pain reliever. At higher doses, our show may also reduce the body's inflammatory response to tissue damage as well as relieve pain. Health Matters can also cause high blood pressure or worsen it if you already have that condition, which can lead to heart problems.
Health Matters can also reduce the effectiveness of certain high blood pressure medications, so avoid our show if you have high blood pressure. If you listen to Health Matters regularly, check your blood pressure frequently and tell your doctor if it rises.
Whatever you do, do not take this stuff lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.